Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Emmett Peppers. We've got a lot to talk about. We have the Russia-Ukraine war. We have the Fed meeting coming up. We have, you know, possible shock into the economy with interest rates, with oil, with lots of different things. We got Tesla news as well. Emmett, how are you doing?
Doing okay. You know, it's been a bit stressful the last several weeks since we last chatted on here on your channel, and a lot of more macro market uncertainties going on with the Russia-Ukraine or Putin-Ukraine conflict. And
that's right. But last time we chatted, it was before this whole thing started. It feels like a whirlwind. It feels like this thing's been going on for months. It's just like so intense.
No one thought that, you know, most people, even like people in Ukraine, you know, that claim to have a really good understanding of what was going on, none of them, the people I talked to, seemed to think that Russia would do a full-scale invasion like that, like they're doing, you know, and it seems to have caught many by surprise.
Definitely. How are you keeping up with all of the news?
Well, there's a lot of really interesting Twitter spaces. You know, in the beginning, there was like this 24/7 Twitter spaces I would listen to on and off, you know, just to make sure like nuclear bombs aren't about to go off or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Russia doing like a full scale invasion of some country that's fighting back, that's sort of backed somewhat by NATO and such. You just kind of worry a little bit. So, there's some Twitter spaces, and I'm just trying to figure out who is the signal and who's the noise. It's hard to know just jumping right into it. Like, you know, obviously everyone's got their own biases. We're all human. So it's hard to kind of counter that or adjust for that when hearing people's opinions. I've listened to the interviews you've had on it, which are helpful. The guy, Dimitri, I can't remember his name, but he does a good Twitter spaces on Sunday nights, actually.
Yeah.
So, just Bill Ackman, hedge fund manager, tweeting a lot about it. I mean, he's very, you know, enthused about, you know, and there's a lot of people in the West that are very, you know, hardcore against Russia. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be hardcore against Russia, but I just don't see enough views for why Putin's doing this, other than he's a madman, psychopath, serial killer. And I mean, that is possible, but
yeah.
You know, I don't know if there's other views that we just don't see that much of in our traditional kind of Western media. I mean, what are your thoughts?
It's been actually consuming a lot of my time. And a lot of it reminds me of COVID in a different sense. Like when we're faced with these kind of rapidly changing sudden events that people haven't expected, it seems like the pace of change is so fast that even the experts don't really know what's going on. Like, you know, there's so many possible scenarios of how this turns out. So everyone is just giving their opinion, but it's so crazy because so much of opinion comes from like biased, you know, political views or, you know, past experience, et cetera. And so you have these lenses that people view this whole scenario through. And it's like really hard, I think, to get good information. And so I've kind of like in the beginning, I was like, you know, watching everything just to get a sense of it. I was like just spending almost all day. And then after a few days, I just started to tune out like almost all of the biased media. So anything that's coming from a defined kind of political view or point, it was like, it doesn't give me much value, you know, it's just all this opinion and stuff. And so I started to just go more into the actual like data, what's really happening on the ground. Following a bunch of Twitter, you know, accounts, some YouTube stuff. And then, also trying to understand Russia and China. I think, you know, it's easy to, I don't say easy, but to understand the West, is I think more natural for most people in the West.
Yeah.
But to understand Russia's interests and China's interests and also some other countries and how this is going to reshape the world, I mean, that's a different question that I don't think many people or enough people are asking, you know?
Yeah. There's like a whole different philosophy on living that, or the government's purpose that these countries have. And, you know, it's sort of alien to us in the West. And, you know, we have our ethics and our morals and such, but, you know, maybe the governments of Russia and China, you know, they don't really have those same ethical rules or moral, you know, teachings that they follow, and they just have their own kind of prerogatives, and they feel like they need to expand to have a sphere of influence in a certain area. Or I don't, it's hard to know, like hard to put ourselves in those shoes when we haven't kind of grown up in that mindset, you know, as the decision makers over there have grown up in those mindsets. You know, I'm not sure it makes them evil, but yeah, they're very different from our mindset. And one analogy I heard that, you know, I don't think it's necessarily true, but one analogy I heard that made me think like, okay, maybe Russia is not completely evil. I mean, it's terrible what's happening. I don't think Russia should have invaded. I'm not saying they should, but like, what if Russia installed like what we thought was a puppet government in Mexico, a puppet communist government in Mexico. And then what if like Russia and China were sending a bunch of, you know, weapons over to Mexico, and suddenly we felt like threatened by all this, you know, potential action of military buildup in Mexico and a puppet communist government infringing, you know, there might be a line where eventually we'd be like, we don't like this. We're going to send in another Bay of Pigs invasion or whatever, like, and stop this before nuclear weapons get, you know, put in Mexico or whatever. So, I mean, that's just one weird point of view I haven't thought of naturally, but, you know, someone had pointed out. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we would, you know, I don't know. I could see Russia's not doing this to be evil. They have some reason why they think this is important. I mean, Putin might have been very ill-informed by his, you know, psychophant advisors. That's a very realistic scenario, too, I'd say, is the people that report to Putin, they're all yes men, and they'll tell him whatever they think he wants to hear because they're all afraid of him, you know? So that's a very realistic scenario, and it just got too far in that direction of Putin's, you know, crazy mind to where he actually thought like he was going to liberate all the Ukrainian population, and it hasn't gone out that way. You know, everyone's trying to fight back. So I don't know. Yeah. That was one thing I thought was interesting, that kind of scenario.
Yeah. I mean, one side, it's like to understand the situation, you have to put ourselves in both sides or multiple sides. I don't think it's just Russia and Ukraine involved. There's so many other countries. And I think that's important. But on the another side, I feel like that's kind of in the past, in a sense, where you could point the finger and blame, you know, different things and different sides, et cetera. But what's going to happen going forward? Like, where is this leading, you know? And what are some actionable items or steps, you know, that we could take? I mean, what's your take right now? Obviously, you know, things can change. And who knows where this war is actually headed, but where are you thinking, you know, things are likely going to head? What's like the most likely scenario, or what are the probabilities like you're kind of, you know, assessing in your head?
Yeah, I think the highest probability is that this kind of drags out for a long time, that, you know, it's going to be a terrible economic collapse for much of the Russian culture and economy, and Ukraine's just going to be in ruins, you know, partially with all, you know, the, you know, shelling they're taking from, you know, missiles and bombs. And it's just going to be a terrible tragedy that maybe it could have been prevented if better communication from the beginning was being done, you know, whether it's, you know, that's in the past. But, you know, I just have a feeling the highest probability is that this drags on for a long time. Then I don't know what probability that's at. I'd say it's like 50% or something. You know, the next scenario is that like maybe Putin and Zelensky finally agree on something. Putin just feels like he's finally realizing that his army is really like taking too much of a hit, and Zelensky's not giving up. So he brokers some kind of deal that he can be left looking good with, you know, Russia's state news saying, hey, Putin wiped out the threat in Ukraine and they're getting demilitarized. They'll never join NATO. And these regions that were, debated are now part of Russia or independent states or something like that. So I feel like that would be like the next likely scenario. I think that'd be the best scenario, to be honest, in terms of world peace and like moving on. The third and fourth scenarios, you know, the third scenario is like Russian, and that maybe is like a 30% chance, I'd say, which is not bad. And then like, you know, maybe there's like a scenario where Putin there's a coup, and it would probably be the state, you know, from what I've understood, like trying to follow as much as I can about Russian culture and how their military and their state security, like their state security seems to be much more higher on the totem pole than the army. And it wouldn't be an army coup, but it would be like the state security coup of Russia, of Putin. And, maybe they feel threatened at some point. And, I'd say that's like a 10% chance, maybe. I don't know. I'm just throwing numbers in the air. But even if that happened, I'm not so sure that's necessarily – everyone thinks, oh, get Putin out of power. And I initially thought that too. But then I'm thinking like, well, be careful what you wish for. Somehow that's creeping my head. Like if something happened to Putin, how do you know whoever's taking over is necessarily going to be, nicer than Putin or not as brutal or more of a dictator than Putin has been, right? You just don't know. It's just a big uncertainty. And then I guess the other thought, that's like 10%. And then the other 10% is just a variety of, things, whether it's Russia completely defeats Ukraine and captures Zelensky and NATO just sits by and lets it happen and Ukraine's captured or other things, there's a lot of potential scenarios, but also included in that is like nuclear tactical weapons being set off by Putin at some point, which could lead to like a World War III event scenario, which could be catastrophic. And so I guess those are my thing. I mean, you would think before nuclear, any given year, the chances of like a nuclear bomb going off is less than 1% maybe on any given year, which still, you don't know if it's 0.1% or close to, I don't know, but it's not zero. But now this year in particular, it feels like it's definitely higher than 1%. I don't know if it's like 5% or 8% or 10%. I don't know, but it certainly feels higher than 1% that there's going to be like a tactical nuke going off soon. And that worries me the most. What do you think the scenarios are, Dave? And if you had to put probabilities on them, what would you think?
Yeah, I think I try to maybe just simplify it into just like a couple of the most likely scenarios. And it looks like at this juncture that Zelensky and Rush and Putin, they want to settle in some ways. They don't want to fight forever. Zelensky seems to be willing to agree to some type of neutrality, but he wants some security guarantees from other countries. And so that might be complicated, but I think it could be done. The sticky issue seems to be the land. So Russia wants Crimea recognized as Russian land and some of the eastern states. I think Russia could, let go of the eastern state demand, but I think they really want Crimea. And so far, Zelensky and his team have been adamant that they're not giving up any land. Right? That's like a stickler for them, right? Yeah. So I think that the strategy that Putin has is he wants to weaken Ukraine and the administration there to the point where they're going to have to, potentially, loosen their obstinance on the land, right? To give up some of the land. But it's interesting. I don't know if you caught this, but did you see this one video that Zelensky was shooting? This was like 3 days ago or so, where he's like, here's my office. I'm still in, the government building that I've always worked in. And he was kind of showing people a tour of his office. And what's interesting about that is like, he even showed like outside, like where, the next buildings were. And it's so interesting because, I didn't hear many people comment on this, but if Putin wanted to take out Zelensky, he could do it immediately. Mm-hmm. He could just send a bunch of missiles, to that building and just crush the building.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, there. Yeah. So it's not that, Putin can't, get rid of Zelensky. It's right now, I don't think Putin wants to actually. And I think it's kind of one of these game theory things, where Zelensky is like, well, if you kill me, it's going to rally my country of
He'll
Ukraine.
He'll become a martyr even more or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And he sees that his whole administration, his whole team, he already has the chain of command, set up. And he's like, these guys are going to die till the end anyways. So his death is going to actually propel people forward. And so he's kind of almost daring
him.
Putin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like that based on that video. But you think that you think that him showing that is sort of a dare, or do you think he's just
For sure. Yeah. And but that's the thing. Putin is not taking that dare because he knows that taking out Zelensky at this point is not going to be advantageous for the end game, right? The end game is you want to weaken your opponent to the point where they're going to take a lopsided agreement, right? Meaning a Russia-heavy agreement. So that's what Putin wants. If Putin kills Zelensky right now, then I don't know if Putin will get that. You know, I mean, Ukraine might just be fighting for a long time. But anyways, I think the most likely scenario is we get some resolution where there's a neutrality agreement. The U.S. and maybe EU, a few countries have to step in with a security guarantee. And I'm not sure about the land, though. That's the tricky part. You know,
I don't think they can do an agreement. Putin is going to have a hard time swallowing that pill, walking away from the land. And I think Zelensky thing, that's what I'm worried about in terms. I think they want to, like you said, but I just think it's going to be hard. Yeah. It's like either all or nothing. I feel like almost for them on the land.
Yeah. So I see how I look at the situation is we're on this road where, you know, one path is going to be a resolution, where it's neutrality for Ukraine, but it's unclear about the land situation, but something has to give. So something has to change and we get a resolution. The other scenario, which I think is less likely.
What do you think on the first one? What's your probability estimate? If you had to put your finger in there and think of a probability for that first scenario, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's 70, 80%. Probably 80%, like we do get
In the next couple of weeks, you think, or it could be like many months later?
I think in the next few weeks to few months, it might not be instant, but
yeah, I think it could drag on for months. But I mean, I think that's the most likely. At some point, they do that, but it could be a while.
Yeah, and then the other scenario is actually it escalates, and either it escalates in a sense where you know we just have a whole nother level of destruction, right, of cities and death and a bigger humanitarian crisis. And it possibly can escalate to, you know, just Russia shooting down the military supplies coming into the country, just like getting really, really close to an all-out, you know, world war in a sense. But I don't think nuclear weapons are really, like, I don't give it much possibility or credence right now at this point. I think it's far less than 1%. Because
less than 1%, you think?
Yeah. And the reason why is I think Russia is in a compromised situation. They know it. They don't have the agreement of the rest of the world.
There was like 100 parallel universes with this exact situation going on at this moment. Yeah. Point forward, there's, you know, different variants in each of the 100 universes that changes it. You think in those 100 parallel universes, there would not be like a tactical nuke set off in any of them, most likely?
Maybe one. Yeah. And I mean, hear me out on the reasoning is maybe one, maybe two, but
that's what I'm saying. 2% is even too high.
Yeah. But those scenarios are really like the mistakes. Like there's an error of like, something happens that's just like kind of crazy, right?
But what about just Putin being kind of, there's questions about his health. What about him? And you know, there's that chain of command thing where people say, oh, there's a chain of command before the nuke. Yeah. But what, you know, what if Putin has them all like scared, deathless, and like, all right, you do this or I'm killing your family. I don't know. Who knows what kind of mafia rules he has set up, but he must know there's a chain of command. And if he wants it to go off, he must know how to get past that chain of command to make it happen. And if he's a nut, if he's really a nutcase psychopath, you know, I don't know if he is or isn't, I would say there's a more than 2% chance he's a really a nutcase psychopath at this point in his life, you know, and that scares me.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So, the scenarios will, so in a few weeks or in a month or two, if things are still really crazy and hot and just, you know, then the probabilities or scenarios will be different. You know, there might be actually a higher chance of escalated conflict. But at this point, the reason why I think it's a low probability is because, Russia has stacked the global opinion against itself, where it's not like a fair, like they have 1/3 of the world supporting them and 2/3 of the world supporting the US or EU. It's not like that type of thing. It's most of the world is, you know, against this invasion. And so that's important because if Russia sets off a nuke somewhere, even if it's like a low yield nuke, what's interesting is Putin has been talking about low yield nukes for a long time. And a lot of people in kind of the Russian sphere of influence have, and scholars have talked about and have generally accepted the use of low yield nuclear weapons as a legitimate kind of tactical approach. So they actually have prepared the thought before this for the past couple of decades, actually, where the Cold War era was like these big nukes would, you know, have a mutually assured destruction, right, concept. But it's shifted to this kind of thought where if you do these low yield, you know, nuclear weapons, then it wouldn't lead to this type of, you know, end of the world situation. Anyways, people can debate about that, but that's kind of a strong train of thought in Russia. But Russia, I think Putin knows if they set off a nuke, they have so little support globally that the US and EU will just, NATO will come in and literally like just bomb all their military, you know, bases inside Russia, and really will just have this crazy reaction, right? I mean, it'll be the whole world against Russia at this point. You think sanctions are bad now? We're talking about, you know, North Korea plus, you know, more sanctions. Like right now, the sanctions against Russia aren't, you can't compare them to the North Korea sanctions right now.
So I'm not sure I agree with that, but go on. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Yeah. Outcome. So what you do is you have these crazy sanctions that are many, many multiple times harsher than now. Then you have US and NATO just coming in, destroying, you know, military capacity inside Russia.
You'd think you'd have China and India at least, you know, being outspoken against it too by that time.
Yeah,
too.
But they won't have the guts to join in because the nuke was set off. Mm-hmm. You know, meaning it's like that's something that's like no one wants, right? And so at the end of the whole story is, yeah, Russia, if they set up more nukes, then it will just get scarier. But at the end of the story, Russia is basically destroyed. In a sense, like they have no more economy, they have no military, and Putin is gone. He's over. And the whole era or the whole identity of kind of this Russia that Putin has been fighting for, like his identity is, or what he thinks of Russia is this historic Russia, right?
Yeah.
The Slavic people, and it's an empire-minded kind of flow of history. All of that is ended. It's over. It's like, And what will come out of Russia will be a completely different, you know, new history. And I don't think Putin knows that that's what's going to happen. It's something that I don't think he's going to do. And it's just off the table. I mean, he cares too much about himself and what he's worked for to set off a nuke and just like, you know, destroy everything, his whole country and everything.
Yeah. I think that's most likely right, that Putin does think that, but I think most likely is not necessarily good enough in my mind that it's not off the table still, that he's not thinking that, and he's just a little off his rocker at this point and like, well, if Russia's going down, the whole world's going down, I'm going to call their bluff and set this nuke, and without Trump in power, no one, Biden's never going to do anything, and the rest of the world's chicken and they're not going to do anything, and I'm going to risk and gamble this, you know, like I could see Putin having that mindset too, potentially. Probably not, but I could see him possibly having that mindset at this phase of his life. Especially if he's like, what if he's like terminally ill and trying to create some kind of, you know, legend for himself, and he's just determined to expand Russia. And, you know, I don't know for sure. I hope, and I think it's most likely what you're saying in terms of his mindset, but I'm not sure. There's just, we don't have all the information.
Yeah. Yeah. What's interesting, like it was about a year ago, I had this thumbnail. It was like World War III or something. Cause like Elon had this one quote about something about kind of the possibility of World War III, but it was like an passing comment, and he was talking about other things and other risks. And the reason why I put this thumbnail, because I actually am very like attuned to global risk, and like a war of global kind of proportions is actually like a real risk because there are hotspots around the world. And when I put out that thumbnail, I got a couple of people that were really offended by the thumbnail saying, oh, you're trying to scare people, you know, like it's just like crazy. And so I took it off and I said, okay, I guess people are scared about, you know, even mentioning, you know, world war or the risk of it. But that's the thing.
We are.
It's like the risk was always there, you know, in terms of global conflict, right? It's just that we don't want to pay attention to that risk. We want to just like not think about it and think it's 0%. And then when it comes in our face, we're like, oh my gosh, it's here now. It wasn't here before, but now we have this risk. 2022 is a risk of, you know, world war or something, right? But that's not the reality. The reality is, no, we've had that risk before. Even nukes. It was like, you know, there's this group, the Atomic Association of Atomic Scientists that have this doomsday clock where they count until like how much before midnight until the world just like blows itself up, destroys itself, right? And it's always getting closer and closer, meaning the risk of nuclear weapons and all this stuff and climate change, it's always like been there. It's just once we get these kind of catalyst events, then people wake up and they're like, oh my gosh, now we have the risk. But no, we've always had the risk before, you know? Anyways, but that kind of helps me a bit when I look at some of these things because, you know, I've been thinking about the risks somewhat beforehand, like looking at the nukes of Russia and India and Pakistan and North Korea, and understanding their arsenal and their strategies and their kind of national policies. Even before this whole thing erupted, then I could, once something happens, then I could lean back on some of that and say, okay, like I understand why these countries are doing what they're doing. And anyways, that's why I'm not like freaked out at the moment, just because I think the Russian move, even though it's crazy and it was miscalculated.
Behind now, but it's been there for a long time. This type of, maybe it's a little bit higher, but it's always kind of been there, and now it's just more in front of our minds. It's dominating the news, and markets are reacting, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even though the Russian invasion was miscalculated, and it was, I think, a stupid invasion, etc. But the thought and the rationale behind the miscalculate is still, I understand, like it's still, it was something that was brewing for many years, and it's something that Russia will try to finish, but they'll try to finish it, I think, in a calculated manner. And throwing a nuke it just doesn't have any calculations to me. I don't know. But
I think that's most likely true. And I also think the same, in a similar light, I have been thinking and reflecting, like we live in a new age of, you know, social media and just media in general on the internet, and how sensational it can be and how clickbaity it can be. And it's just like, it's so good at drawing fear in our minds, because then we're more likely to click on it. Right. So it's like maximum fear news more than we've ever seen. And it keeps getting more and more like that. Right. And whether it's COVID or whatever, and throughout decades, you know, earlier in my life, there was issues like this going on, but it was before the internet, and it was even before CNN. It would be reported in the nightly news, and you would think maybe our parents or whatever would be worried a little bit, but I'm wondering if they're even as worried as we are, because we just are seeing it 24/7 and the worst scary headline possible things from it. And so just the advent of the internet media with advertising business models with clickbait news headlines, you know, just that accelerating over the last, you know, decade or so has made something like this even scarier than maybe it otherwise would be if this was happening, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah. I tweeted out a few weeks ago, kind of like the nuclear arsenal of Russia and the US. And, I got some comments of people like, oh, don't freak people out. You know, it's like on nukes, like people don't want to talk about it. But, it's like, it is kind of scary in the sense there's been so many near accidents in the past like 60 or 70 years where we've actually almost had nuclear war.
Higher percentage.
A lot of times.
Now for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and some of these stories.
This or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, some of these stories haven't really been told in detail, but it's like we were really, really close quite a few times.
Yeah, even with like Russia and the U.S. Cold War, like them thinking there's a button and someone being ordered to push it. I've heard some interesting, crazy stories. And like, there was like one Russian guy who's like notorious for like standing up and be like, I'm not pushing that button. I think this is a false alarm. And otherwise, if he didn't do that, the world could have ended. Crazy.
Yeah. I remember you were saying like you hedged a bit a couple weeks ago. What did you do? Did you buy puts on the index or on NASDAQ?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. I mean, when this war first started happening, I was nervous and I bought some short dated NASDAQ puts in my personal Canada fund. I think we talked about it on our live stream, so I can talk a little bit about it. But, yeah. And then I transitioned. They were, a couple of days away from expiring worthless. So while there was still some time value, transitioned them, to longer dated, further out of the money strike puts. You know, I think it was close to 4,000 strike price for the NASDAQ or the S&P, and NASDAQ was like 12,000 strike price, something like that. So, like a month out, because I'm wondering if every week the market's just going to drift down like 3 to 5%, just for the next several weeks as it drags on and there's uncertainty and such. So that's just part of my thinking. Like initially it was just because what if there's a tactical nuke set off, and I just didn't know. Even Putin mentioned the language like get his nuke deterrence team ready or whatever. I don't know, it just seemed like it was escalating really fast, and what if he's really unstable mentally and blah blah blah. And then as it became kind of less likely that was going to go off in the next few days, I realized let's extend this to be further out. And so far it's hasn't really done much. It's about even money, even though the market's going down, because these puts are expensive. But yeah, if the market takes a real turn for the worse and drops 10 or 20%, it helps soften the blow for me personally and our fund for sure. So I think the fund, I think it was just like 3% of the fund's assets or something on this hedge, and mm-hmm. same with my personal account, something like that. Mm-hmm. But just something to help me sleep at night, This is a very strange time, and I usually have a thought, like I feel like there's some kind of direction I think the market's going to go, and this is like one of the first times I was thinking like that. I really don't know which way the macro markets are going to go at this point. Like, it's scary, like now there's all the talk of the commodities issues and like food short, and this is a lot of fear mongering headlines, but the commodity, there's probably some real, news to that, like with nickel prices soaring, oil up so high. And so there's definitely going to be an effect on the economy to increase the likelihood of a recession, so there's lots of downstream effects going on. And, the market's totally oversold on the tech stocks, I think for sure. But I feel like this overselling can continue. The market can stay irrational longer than I can stay liquid, probably. So I have to, I don't know. This might not be a V-shaped recovery like COVID. This could be a long, drawn-out U recovery that could last, many months or a year or more. So even the long-term leaps, it's hard to say, like, are a good value at this time. What do you think about? Have you done any hedges or have you?
Yeah. Not really. I'm just kind of sitting back and holding and chilling. And I think it helps a lot where
you don't have any margin. I wish I didn't have any margin. I could sit back and relax, but I've borrowed to pay my tax, like exorbitant taxes.
Yeah.
It's a rough ride with margin. I'm definitely stressing. But yeah, if I didn't have any margin whatsoever, I feel like I'd more likely not do the hedges and just kind of sit back and let it play out.
Yeah.
Is that what you're sort of doing?
Yeah, it's kind of like right now it's like the power of just common stock comes to play, where it's like you're able to, there's no time decay, there's no like extra leverage.
No Tesla. I mean, mm-hmm. we know Tesla where it's going to be in 5 or 10 years, whatever the path is between there, and we know where it's going to be when you can sit back and watch it, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the way I look at it is I think I would be more like calculated and cautious and doing something, some diversified, whatever approach in some ways, if it wasn't the case where I really believed in Tesla's trajectory over the next 1 to 3 years. I just think mm-hmm. they're in that, really sweet spot where it's just, just everything's going right at this moment. And they're at just the cusp of so many different, catalysts with profit, with margins, with possible, full self-driving income, all this stuff. And so I just feel like, I just want to capture that, and I'm okay with the volatility and just, you know, like I kind of weigh it where I go, okay, you know, I could try to capture the ups and downs and try to, like, you know, cushion the fall and try to, you know, maximize upside, all this stuff. Yeah. Or I could, on another angle, I could say, hey, I just want the upside. You know, even though it'll be volatile, I'm okay with it going from like 0 to 50 to 0 to 50, 0 to 50, whatever that up and down is, as long as it ends up at 100, you know, like, so that's kind of my angle right now. And that's why actually it's been actually pretty chill. Looking at the markets. I don't know if I feel like the move that I'm entertaining the most is kind of like, I've got some side accounts that I I might take on more riskier things. And I'm waiting for that time, or considering when and if to leverage up with with more like long dated, like leaps, let's say with Tesla or something else, or is there some other, you know, just crazy hit stocks where I'm like, how far can they go down? You know, it's like, If the market turns, you know, some of these stocks are just going to rip and it's just going to be crazy. So, it seems like, you know, the risk reward equation for taking leaps out on hard hit stocks, or even your favorite stocks, it seems like it's getting to that sweet spot where it could pay off. I'm just not sure yet. I think if the market continues to go down, then it's just going to be like this itchy, kind of more obvious, you know, opportunity where like, oh my gosh, it's like, it's good to, at least in my kind of, you know, portfolio, I might say, hey, you know, we might take some and, you know, kind of leverage up, you know, with some options. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the line that keeps coming to my mind is like, you know, that line that whatever goes up must come down, you know, like with gravity. But this is it with the stocks and good business. Assuming it's a good business, it's the opposite. Whatever goes down must come up, you know. And I always think about that. Like, so with Tesla, whatever goes down must come up, you know, eventually it's going to come back up to be higher, you know. And so for the good businesses, those stocks, even if, you know, they were trading at crazy multiples before, if they're a good business that's worth that type of multiple, you know, before in the future, you know, even if it's been cut down by 80%, that's a lot, you know, what goes down must come back up eventually, you know? And so whether that's later this year or in 2 or 3 years, if that business is truly worth what the multiple was before, and it's accelerating growth at 50% plus per year, has some unique technology or competitive advantage or moat, then assuredly that stock will then go back up sooner or later, you know, but, it's hard to do that if you're using margin or leveraged with long-term call options that might expire before it comes back up, you know. So you have to be careful. But I do think there's a huge fire sale going on with a lot of these stocks. It's just, who knows, if you're buying the common stock and not using margin, great opportunities.
I mean, I guess the big risk is kind of like this long drawn out, you know, bottom where, you know, you think it's going to be a bounce and your leaps or whatever, if it's expiring in a year or two, you think it's a long time, but the possibility is it could just for next year or two, just kind of languish, you know, a bit. Maybe it bounces a bit, but it's not enough really to, you know, justify the time decay even. I guess that's the risk. Right. What's interesting is it feels like the market and investors are getting, it's bordering on kind of this irrational, I don't say irrational, but this aggressive dislike, almost an allergic reaction of some sort to growth stocks and tech tech growth stocks, right? So, you take some of these businesses that are just been crushed 80% or something, the stock, and you take like a Zoom, right? Or a Teladoc or some others, and like people will be like, this business just sucks. It's just like terrible. And they're like, I wouldn't even buy it if it's $10, you know, or something, or it gets to this point of irrationality where it's just like anything of tech and growth, they just don't want to touch. And it's exemplified with, like, for example, Cathie Wood's fund, where people are like, I don't even want to look at that thing. That whole thing is just, you know, like everything she touches, like I'm just not gonna, you know, think about her. Yeah, stay away. It's, and it gets this point of like, even if it goes down another 50%, I don't care, right? That's the whole sentiment. And I'm like, wow, it's such a fascinating like demonstration of human psychology in a way, where you think that the markets, you know, are numbers driven, and you know, there's a certain valuation on a company that's justified, et cetera. But in times like this, you see that a lot, like the bulk of it is like sentiment. It's how you view kind of the overall markets, how you view that industry or that, you know, type of company. And it radically shapes, you know, investor interest in that. And that's always been kind of the biggest risk I've seen with tech stocks or growth stocks is, you know, you buy into this kind of exuberant, the good times valuation, where you think that, hey, that's the real valuation of the company, because for the past 5 years, it's been valued like that by all the investors. But you don't realize like, that's largely sentiment driven in the sense that for 5 years, it's looked good. And there's so much sentiment, but then when the sentiment changes and shifts, and they don't give the aggressive multiples, they don't like the industry, everything, it can tank, you know, 80% like we've seen. And that's always like, you know, I talk about like with Tesla stock, I always like discount my holdings in my head by like 70% or even more sometimes, just because, you know, there's the sentiment aspect of valuation of the stock price. Yeah. That I think
of all stocks, basically of all growth tech stocks, sentiment changes.
And I think we just typically people underestimate how much of a stock's value is the sentiment value, you know, and that sentiment can fluctuate from exuberance to pessimism and mid and back and forth or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you can't extract that sentiment factor from a stock price. It's always going to be there in some form or fashion, right? Adding a big plus or adding a minus or something in between. But I mean, I think that's, to me, this is just like a huge just example of that, you know? How can stocks, like, how can some of these stocks like get shot like 80%, you know? It's like crazy.
Yeah. It's
just coming to light. It's sentiment is a big factor, you know, in a lot of stock prices.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a different mindset for the macro market right now on stocks overall. Like maybe there's just a big rotation out of stocks in general, and people are going to hold commodities and fixed income for a while. And basically all stocks are, you know, getting lower valuations because of that. You know, that's possible. And that could be multiple years, you know, before stocks become in favor with the macro market, institutional money again, you know. So you just don't know. This could be a long run for stocks to kind of come back, or maybe there'll be a bounce back sooner. But the guy you had on once from Spot Gamma, he had an interesting interview, I think on Thursday, with a podcast called Contrarian Investor, I think. Mm-hmm. I listened to, Matt had brought to my attention, and he was speculating that you know, March quarterly expiration of the indices like NASDAQ, you know, that's the most common way to hedge for institutional managers, is to buy puts on these indexes and such. And they're expiring on Friday of this coming week, March 18th. And so his speculation was that the theta decay on those, many of them are in the money or at the money, you know, hedges or close to the money, will accelerate going into Friday, and it'll cause the market makers and dealers on the other side who are delta neutral to have to buy back the index, you know, in order to keep themselves delta neutral as those hedges decay, and that these institutions, you know, they will be less likely to kind of re-up their hedges for the same amount of, you know, delta dollars, so to speak, or maximum exposure for the next quarterly put cycle, because that's like the most common one, is the March, June, September, December puts, you know, those quarterly expirations. So that was his speculation. I'm not sure that's true or not, but he was sort of pointing to, was like, hey, he thinks we'll have maybe a short term, or maybe not a short term, but some kind of bounce in the next few days in the market, just because of all the people having to cover their shorts, all the market makers having to cover their shorts that they had to short to hedge their put position that they had sold to institutional money.
Yeah, yeah, That's interesting. I think, like on the kind of more positive or, optimistic side on the market, I think we're not facing, at least, it doesn't look like we're facing any type of liquidity crisis or banking crisis or lending crisis. Meaning there isn't this structural type of blocking of investments where people have to hold or you can't put in, right? And you've got this huge pump of liquidity in the system as well. So you have a lot of people with a lot of money sitting there. And, real estate has already gone up a lot. I don't know if people want to like up the game and double in on real estate. I mean, possibly, but, bonds, I don't know. I just think that great companies, I just think they're rare, I mean, they're something that you just, they're going to have its value. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think Tesla hasn't gone down as much as some of these other companies that have gone down 80% or more, because Tesla's entering, it's not at the Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft type of top echelon of tech stocks, where it's not getting hit that much. Because there's a lot more, kind of uncertainty in terms of how much growth at what pace and all this stuff. So, but even with that, it's like, Tesla has done actually relatively, pretty decent compared to most, growth stocks. And I think it's just, is one of these things where in the bigger picture, it's like great companies that are growing that have huge kind of markets and opportunities ahead of them for 5 or 10 years, and they can grow for, let's say, 50%, and their profits and everything is growing. They have cash on hand, sufficient. Those companies are great investments in some ways. I mean, sure, the price is going to go through the whole volatility of sentiment change and all that. But that's what I kind of come back to, I think, in this environment where, I don't know where else I'd want to put, my money right now. I mean, it's always tempting to just like, to take a break or, pull out, just put it, to have some type of so-called safety. But I don't know. Yeah. To me, it doesn't seem that safe in a sense that, you have money that's losing its value. That's the thing. Like people think that, the S&P 500, NASDAQ indexes can fall another 20%, which obviously anything can happen. But you also have to look at, we have inflation, and a lot of things where, it's like, I think stocks can hold their value, like good companies. And so it's, I don't know, it's just, I'm not sure where else, is a compelling place, to put money, but I don't know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, cash is king at the moment, but, inflation, like you said, this last year has been pretty high, but historically, what is it, like 2 or 3% most of the last couple of decades or something. So, if you're just holding cash, last few decades, you're losing like 3% a year on average of your value. But then there's those outlier years like this year where the cash is now worth 50% more relative to most of the stocks in the stock market you'd be interested in buying or whatever, so there's kind of those outlier years for cash to US dollars to perform well and commodities too now. So this is one of those years, but it can't keep happening, especially with inflation, cash is great sometimes at certain times for shortened spurts of time when the market is crashing or correcting or in a bear market. But I agree, if you own a great company, Tesla, Amazon, Microsoft, one of the great companies, Apple, if you've owned one of those companies make up, I think there's been studies like 90% plus of the S&P's returns, without like the top five companies in S&P the last 20 years, the S&P would have returned like zero or something. So as long as you have there's some study like that, but as long as you own one of those top few companies, and Tesla's clearly one of them, then you're gonna do amazing over the medium to long term. Not just, you know, except from 2013 to 2019, it was a tough run for Tesla, the stock, but you were rewarded, you know, after that, obviously. But there could be another run of 2 or 3 years where Tesla stock languishes, you know, and maybe you'll get rewarded after that. But yeah, it's in the medium, like 3 to 5 year picture or longer, it's like no brainer that owning Tesla stock or some other stock that's as important as Tesla is, you know, is the thing to do versus going to cash. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. I mean, like, let's talk about Tesla prospects a bit. It seems like in terms of stock price expectations for you, like you're not cashing in, you know, all of your common stock for leaps right now on Tesla. And it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you just see the next 1 to 2 years as being having a decent amount of risk, where it's just not completely clear to you that it's going to just have this quick bounce and justify, you know, the leverage that you put into, let's say, options. So you're kind of like, but past that point, past the 1 to 2 years, it's much more clear to you that, you know, the trajectory. I mean, is it the combination of kind of all these different concerns of, you know, possible recession, you don't know where this war is going to head, just interest rates, like what's like top of your mind in terms of what's leading kind of this uncertainty for you?
Yeah, the macro markets and, you know, the recession that could be coming hard if the commodities really shock the whole world economy. It could be a global recession that we haven't seen in a while. If gas prices are $10 a gallon here in the U.S., imagine what they are in the rest of the world, right, for example. And then there's all the metals and, you know, shortages of metals or stuff that normally comes out of Ukraine and Russia and such. And so, you know, there could be, if that happens and there's a shock, like the whole macro market, you know, maybe even the macro market just trades side. Maybe we've come down and the macro market trades mostly sideways for a couple of years, or maybe trends down, you know, a little bit or further first and then trade sideways. But in that case, I could see Tesla just trying to trade sideways, even though it's performing really well, or maybe going down to $500 a share, worst case, in the next few months if the whole market's kind of crashing further. But I think in, you know, 2 years, 3 years from now, Tesla's fundamentals will be so caught up that the PE will be like great for a company growing, you know, 40-50% a year still at that time, you know, and people say, well, the PE of Tesla is now like under 20 or whatever, and it's growing for, like, this stock should be, and then it'll just go up at that point based on, you know, having incredible earnings capacity. Be like, oh, this thing's going to pay dividends sooner or later, and it'll be worth it for sure. Like, and so, you know, I think worst case is, you know, maybe that kind of realization doesn't happen for Tesla stock for another 2 or 3 years if the whole macro market kind of continues to flutter and trade down or sideways, you know. So that's my worry. So you know, we all know most of the people watching all know in 5 years, 10 years, Tesla's going to be monstrous. But, you know, for the next 1 or 2 years, you know, it's still seen as a growth tech stock, you know, and it's not until like the earnings PE and, you know, the classic indicators of the stock, you know, until it kind of comes in line with like a value stock that possibly it could start going up significantly at that point. And that's my thought. I don't know. What do you think? That's worst case. And I think it's realistic at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the thing. It's like, with markets, it's, you know, like you might be convinced that, you know, it's going to look like this or go this way, but there's always that uncertainty. There's so many factors that, you know, there's always people that, you know, come around along and they say, oh, I've got the gift of, you know, predicting the future and knowing where the markets are headed. And I always see it happen over and over where after they call a few right ones and then they make the mistake and it becomes evident that you just don't know, you know, with certainty, you know, where the market's going to be headed, right? And I think that's the challenge of, investing.
Like, you know where certainty where the business is going, but you don't know. The stock is a completely different thing business in a lot of cases.
Yeah. And a lot, like what I was talking about earlier, is like, if so much of the stock price is sentiment related, you know, based. Macro market
sentiment.
It's like, how do you know where, you know, how the market's going to treat the company with the sentiment aspect, you know? Do we know in a few months the whole market's going to be, you know, exuberant or still pessimistic? There's probabilities, but we're not sure, right? And so I think what you bring up is definitely like a legitimate scenario. I mean, that's pretty much the reason why I'm not, you know, changing all my stock to leaps right now, because it's like uncertain, right? There's like, like these risks that we're facing are real risks. And that's the thing. A few months ago, we didn't have war. We didn't have commodity prices skyrocketing. We didn't have like, you know, a global situation in flux right now. Like, this is a different situation right now. There's some, I think some, definitely some real risks possibly ahead. I definitely think that's a legitimate concern.
The one kind of curveball is if Tesla does go, you know, is able to deliver full self-driving to the masses later this year, you know, that changes the equation significantly. But I'm not convinced that's going to happen yet. I hope it does, but I'm not convinced. I mean, I think it's very possible, but I'm just not convinced. It's just a possible scenario. But if they do, the software margins and next year, the implications of being able to introduce maybe like robotaxi services in a couple cities and then expanding beyond that over the year after, you know, I think that could really dramatically change the stock price, you know, even if the macro market's really having a tough time. But that's the curveball in my thought process, I guess. You know, we'll see.
On the flip side, I mean, did you get a chance to watch this interview by Puru Saxena that I did like several months ago? He was calling for like a kind of a market correction. This is back like in November or so.
I see that. Yeah. Before the Fed changed.
He was
right on. I mean, the Fed, there's things that happen after in the macro market, you know, the Fed changes, you know, changed from viewing inflation as transitory to something they have to act on. And that kind of kicked off the correction.
And, so I've been wanting to get him back on my channel and then to interview him. And he's been kind of waiting till it's getting close to what he thinks is the bottom or close to it. And so he actually thinks we're getting pretty close. He says he's not sure on the exact bottom, but he thinks that, you know, if you, you know, buy into kind of these growth stocks that have been hit hard, but are great companies, just over DCA over the next, you know, month or so, then that's pretty much like one of the best type of risk reward, you know, situations you're going to get. Sure, it can go down, possibly lower than that, but his kind of rationale, it appears, and I'll be talking to him actually next week, actually, Thursday or so. He wanted to wait until the Fed meeting after. And my rationale, what I'm thinking of is he sees that, you know, there's been a lot of just pessimism toward, you know, the markets, growth stocks, and the Fed kind of being hawkish. And there seems to be a possibility that the Fed kind of reverses course a bit and says, hey, we can't raise interest rates that much because of, you know, this inflation, not just with all these commodity prices increasing, the war, you know, oil, gas, all this stuff, you know. And so it's possible, even likely, the Fed kind of holds off a bit, you know, on their aggressive type of rate hikes. So
swing the pendulum back.
So you have like a, you know, modest, you know, quarter point hike, and then you have kind of,
it depends on their language, I guess. Of the market priced in 20 a quarter of a point, they priced in 25 basis point hike initially here, but I guess it all depends on their signaling or their language going forward.
I think there's a decent chance that, you know, if like they're not as aggressive and they don't signal as aggressive behavior as before, and they kind of are like, we're going to hold back a bit because of this war, and then let's say hypothetically the war ends, right, and commodity prices actually just like crash because of, you know, the war ending, and the market just like takes off, you know, and we look back at this time, we're like, oh my gosh, this was like, you know, a crazy time, right, to buy it. And that's definitely, you know, possible situation as well.
Yeah. I hope that's the world we're living in. Yeah. I hope
that. Yeah, but you never know. Yeah. For sure. Do you think there's any added risk to Tesla that's kind of new, created risks in the past, you know, month or so, especially with this war, increased commodity prices, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of risks. I mean, a small risk is there's like this new COVID surge in China, and it's like the Omicron wave might be hitting China pretty hard right now. And, you know, what if they shut down the factories again? You know, what if China has like that zero tolerance policy and shut down the factories for a month or something? You know, that could hurt Tesla stock, you know, in a short term, you know, but medium to long term, you know, there was that big sell off at the end of towards the end of last week of a lot of Chinese ADRs. And I wonder if Tesla's kind of aggressive sell off is somehow related to some of that, because I think there's worries that, you know, relations between the US and China could get a little hectic, you know, or with, you know, trying to impose Russia sanctions and China not, you know, it just could get tough, you know. And I guess if you're worried about U.S.-China relations and Tesla's caught in the crossfire, that could be a real problem, you know. That's one of the biggest risks I see for Tesla, is some geopolitical risk between Tesla in the U.S. and China if Tesla were to get caught in the crossfire there. So that's the biggest risk I see. You know, there's some. I think there's a little bit of elevated key man risk to Elon, you know, kind of helping out Ukrainians with Starlink. You know, I'm not sure how elevated that is, but certainly more than it was before he helped them with Starlink. I'm not saying he shouldn't have, but he's certainly more on the radar as kind of an enemy of Russian invaders at this point, trying to stifle their progress there. So, you know, hopefully has the best security possible. But those are the types of risks I see. You know, commodities pricing, you know, I think Tesla, you know, if they have to raise the prices of their vehicles another 1,000 or 2,000, you know, they can easily do that and handle, they won't be supply constrained still. So I'm not worried so much about the commodities. Maybe I should be, I haven't studied that enough. But I know they have a whole different types of battery chemistries they can go with, and they can adjust to if they need to. They have a Baskin-Robbins. I listened to your interview with the guy, I think a couple of days ago. He was interesting, but then he started talking about like hydro peanut butter. And I was like, oh man, I listened to an hour of this guy. Now I hear this, that like set me up. Like maybe I shouldn't have listened to anything he said. If he's talking about, you know, I was like, oh. Like, you know, when you hear certain things people say, sometimes you just want to dismiss everything else they've said. And I'm sure people say that about me. It's not necessarily true. But, you know, anyway, I think they have a variety of different battery chemistries they can use with different, you know, whether it's iron phosphate or nickel or less. Yeah. I think that some of their batteries have zero cobalt in them at this point. Yeah. Some of them very little, but some have zero even, I think, if I remember. So I'm not sure commodities is going to be a big issue for their batteries. What are your thoughts on Tesla and the biggest risks, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest risk is kind of material costs. So, you know, the cars, they do take a lot of, you know, materials, you know, aluminum, steel, copper, you know, nickel, all this stuff. And so if the prices increase rapidly, it's a mix of how much does Tesla have, you know, the prices locked in, versus, you know, are they paying market prices? My guess is it's some type of combination where they have some of it, like a part, I don't know how much of it, it could be majority, is like locked in. And then maybe there's some of it that's of that price that's fluctuated, you know, that's floated on the market or something. And it probably varies because they have a ton of different, you know, suppliers and places they're getting, you know, these commodities from. And so, I mean, the risk is you have commodity prices skyrocket, Tesla's hypothetically having to pay a lot more, and then they raise their prices, but it's not enough. And you don't want to over raise your price, because then it's like, it gets all confusing, because what if the commodity prices tank, you know? And so it could hurt Tesla's margins a bit, where, you know, you think that they're going to get over 30% margins, right? But if they're getting hit hard on raw material costs, it could, you know, you could see some headwinds with margins. And it could come in lower than expected, and you might be like, what's going on? And the market might overreact at that point, right? Put and combine that with kind of the startup expenses of Austin and Berlin, where the first car is off the line, they're going to be extremely negative gross margin. They're going to hit, you know, overall gross margins somewhat. I'm unclear exactly how much that's going to be, but you're looking at two new factories that are ramping, right? And so,
wait, I want to make one point on the two new factories real quick. Is there's that new? They announced a new China factory coming up soon, right? In Shanghai, I think, right? Again,
I don't know if they announced it or if it was like a rumor, but
I thought there was some official announcement, like they're going to move forward with it or they're approved for it. You know, I'm not sure how official, but it was a rumor originally like months ago, and now something else came out. I think like
I heard like it was, it was a rumor before, then it supposedly it was like more official, then someone was saying it's not official. It's actually still like in process, preliminary.
Well, if it's true, if it's true, and I think it's more than likely true, but if it is, then that's a bigger deal to me than Giga Berlin and Austin combined, because Giga Berlin and Austin are each initially set for 500,000 maybe each, let's say. But this one's going to be set for 1 million to begin with. And it'll go up pretty quickly because the China manufacturer, it'll be probably ramped up to 1 million not long after Giga Berlin and Austin have had a chance to finally ramp up to 1 million, which they might be slower ramping up than China at this point. So I could see it being built in a year and a half, and then ramped up within a year after that. Or it might take Giga Austin, Berlin each year, 2 years to ramp up to 500,000 each. You know, I don't know. But just the margin, the gross margin of the cars out of China. And it's, there's some language like in the approval, like it's going to be an export hub of the world, or, you know, Asia or whatever. And the margin of the cars they manufacture in China are, I think, by far the most profitable cars Tesla makes at this time. You know, the cars that are exported out of China. So that to me is like bigger news almost from a numbers perspective on the balance, you know, on the revenues, the bottom line for Tesla in terms of gross margins. I mean, yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted, it was one of those underrated things I don't think people are appreciating enough. It'll take 2 years to really pay off big time, but I think it will. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
No, I agree. I mean, like China, like you can get things done so fast there, you know, like you can ramp very fast. Yeah, definitely.
So you're saying the biggest risk with the China, the margins and stuff taken.
I mean, so you could see margins coming in, you know, Q1, it could be a little disappointing for the market, you know, and investors, and that's a risk. And also Q2, maybe it doesn't recover as much as people expect. So, you know, That's just a short term type of, you know, risk. It might not be realized. Who knows? Maybe the margins will be great. I don't know, because they did have price increases prior as well. So yeah, a lot of unknowns. But I was reading today, I don't know if you caught this article. It was from AutoNews.com. It was saying that Ford says that they're not going to give any new dealer allocations of cars until May, and it's because they lost 100,000 kind of production due to supplier shortages.
I saw that headline.
You know,
I didn't
So I was looking into that. I'm like, wow, you know, it's you think that supply chain is all fixed by year 2022, that, you know, this is the year that auto production ramps back up and then the prices for cars start to come back down. But this news just from Ford, it's possible that this supply chain challenge might continue to go on for a while, and you're not going to see this huge flood of new car production this year. And if that's the case, that's actually bullish for Tesla, because they're the ones who are able to kind of sidestep this, you know, supply chain constraints with, you know, their own software and all this other stuff. But so that's actually good news. It gives Tesla the leverage to price, you know, aggressively, and demand will be hot, will be strong, especially with oil and gas where it's at. Those are definitely some positives. Another positive is with this whole Russia you know, thing going on. The Biden administration might feel more emboldened to push through an EV tax credit because they're like, hey, let's get off of oil and gas, you know, or oil from Russia, et cetera, which we are. But so this might be a catalyst actually for Tesla, you know, just this whole situation. So it's something definitely, you know, I think to look out for as well.
Yeah. I hope this, I'm hoping the supply chain stuff doesn't hurt Tesla, like the chip shortage has to some degree. I mean, they've been able to sidestep it, like you said, better than anyone else, but it still has affected their production capacity last year. So whatever the new supply chain issues are with Ford, as long as Tesla can, you know, sidestep in a way that doesn't affect their production capacity, I agree. It's definitely a positive for Tesla.
Yeah, definitely. But again, I think the biggest risk for Tesla is the overall, like in terms of its stock price, right? The biggest risk is the overall just, you know, macro environment, the sentiment. But in terms of Tesla, the business, you know, it's like humming along.
Do you think there's any risk with like geopolitical risk between US and China for Tesla?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't see really any short term. I think a lot of this stuff brings up questions more longer term, like the 5 to 10 year window. Mm-hmm. I think China right now is too just motivated. They're too motivated, too cautious. They're not going to push the envelope. I don't think Tesla is even near any risk. But who knows? Like with the elevated kind of rhetoric between the U.S. and China and hostilities, and who knows what will happen with Russia too. If this thing escalates and China takes Russia's side in a stronger way, I mean, yeah, it can get kind of messy. Who knows? Yeah, it could get really messy really fast. I mean, yeah, that's the thing. It's like you have these unlikely scenarios that one thing
any one escalate. Of them happens, it sets up a huge domino effect that can go to any crazy direction that it's hard to predict.
You know? Yeah. And that's what makes makes it like unnerving. If like, I don't know how people can try to like time the markets and like really predict the future. I mean, it just seems like, I don't know. It's a tough one right now.
Yeah.
Limited visibility, I think definitely with what's going on in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Anything else? Curious that's on your mind, the past few weeks?
No, nothing really. Just trying to not lose sleep over macro markets. Yeah. Try not to lose sleep. I mean, the war is such a terrible thing. It's so catastrophic. You know, it's such a human, you know, tragedy. You just got to pray that it ends soon. So much senseless killing going on. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like just communications needs to be better between like leaders of countries. You know, there's even better communication. Like you need like therapists between the countries' leaders to like get them figuring out each other's mindset. And, you know, I feel like they're just talking with tanks and, you know, fear mongering each other. And then one of them gets dared to say, okay, I'm pulling in the tanks then. And it's sad. You know, you feel like some of this stuff could be worked out, you know, if Putin sat down with Zelensky and had like a middle therapist and they would just talk, you know, regularly. I don't know. It's just sad. These wars, seeing it happen in today's world.
I mean, I don't know if you caught like, so the French, President Macron, he's been calling Putin actually quite often and they're having these like long, having these long conversations, like an hour and a half. And then I think it was yesterday, the German chancellor and, Macron, they both called Putin for like over an hour and a half or something. And so I think that's actually, you know, it's a small thing, but
it's helpful.
It's like, you've got to just pick certain things that you can kind of say, maybe there's something going on where if the lines of communication are open, at least, right. Between France, Germany, right. Russia, they're talking and it's long conversations directly, right. With key decision makers. You've got to have, I think it's not like, saying it's 100% guarantee it's going to be over, there's going to be resolution, et cetera. But it's a much better situation where compared to there's no lines of communication, right? Like Putin doesn't want to talk to anybody. Like that's a scary situation. That's like, you know, but I don't think we're in that, but we'll see. At least not yet.
I mean, I think last time we ended our chat and we're like, I'm sure things are going to change a lot. Next time we didn't know it would change this much, but I'm sure things will change a lot between now and the next time we chat too. Hopefully.
Yeah, definitely.
Hopefully, Peruk, the guy you interview, is somewhat right and close to the bottom here.
Yeah. We'll see. I'm gonna drill him, trying to get see like if he really has like some, substance to this hunch of his. You know that we're close. We'll see.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
All right. Emma, take care. Have a good week. It's been fun talking and catching up as well.
Certainly. All right, Dave. Good chatting.
All right. We'll see you.
All right.
Bye. See you.